Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello, and welcome back. In today's episode, I'm excited to welcome Michelle Callen to the How I Lawyer podcast. Michelle is a partner in the appellate practice at Jenner & Block here in Washington, D.C. Immediately prior to returning to private practice in September 2022, Michelle was special litigation counsel to the United States House of Representatives Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attacks on the Capitol. And before that, she spent almost 4 years in the Solicitor General's office for the Commonwealth of Virginia, my home state, my home Commonwealth. First, she served as Deputy Solicitor General, and then she served as the Solicitor General of the Commonwealth's Chief Appellate Lawyer. She started her career as a law clerk on the Sixth Circuit and as an associate at two D.C. law firms. She's a graduate of Stanford University, go Cardinal, and Vanderbilt Law, go Commodores. Thanks for being here, Michelle. I'm super excited for the conversation.
Same here. Thank you for having me.
So I always like to start by learning a little bit about the decision to become a lawyer. Like, if you are a superhero, what's your origin story? What brought you to the profession? And maybe what kind of lawyer did you think you were going to be once you got started?
Sure. So I kind of always felt like I was going to be a lawyer. I think it's because people told me that I liked to talk and argue as a child and liked logic. And so I had it in my mind that I would be a lawyer. And when I went to college and met people and learned a little bit more about the law, it seemed like a really fun, interesting field. I don't have any lawyers in my family, so meeting people through college was really a way that confirmed that law was an interesting area to go and practice.
So given that you didn't sort of have any lawyers in your family and you started learning about what it meant to be a lawyer from friends in college, did you have any sense of sort of what kind of lawyer you wanted to be when you decided to go to law school?
I had no sense at all. If someone told me that I would be an appellate lawyer someday, I would have no idea what that meant.
And how did that come about? Like, talk to me a little bit about Michelle during law school. Like, what sort of struck your fancy or what excited you during that period in your life?
Sure. So I actually started law school at UCLA as a 1L and was part of their public interest program. I was very interested in going to law school to do good in the world. And UCLA's public interest program very much appealed to me. I ended up transferring to Vanderbilt, where my now husband, then fiance, was in medical school. And when I transferred to Vanderbilt, I had the opportunity to join the Appellate Litigation Clinic, which was my first taste into appellate law. And when an opportunity came about to argue a case, I put my name in the hat for that and was lucky enough to be selected. Part of the reason why I had the opportunity for the oral argument is because all of the prep took place over Thanksgiving break. So there wasn't much competition in terms of who wanted to take the argument. And so because I was willing to give up on my Thanksgiving break, I got to argue a Sixth Circuit case in law school. And that gave me the appellate bug to then try and secure an appellate clerkship and then do quite a bit of appellate work pro bono when I went to law firms. But it was the clinic that really gave me a taste of what appellate litigation was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things in that answer that I think are worth shouting out, right? The first, of course, is that sometimes we plan and sometimes we find someone that changes our plan, and that's okay. I remember having these same conversations with my then girlfriend, then fiance, and now wife, because she was in law school also, and trying to negotiate that. I know it's really hard for people who have partners in the medical profession because they have a lot less control, I think, in many ways where they go. But it sounds like you made the best of all those transitions. And then the part I really want to shout out is if you don't know what you want to do, you have to go out and try things. And you did that in the clinic and got that opportunity. Tell me a little bit more what it was like to argue at the Sixth Circuit, if you can remember, as a student.
It was very exciting. And I was lucky enough to work with a fantastic partner. So it was myself and another woman. She didn't do the argument, but we kind of were the team on the case. Mm-hmm. And she's a rock star partner now at Kirkland. And so that was fantastic to work closely with her. It was also fantastic to work with our professor who was running the clinic. She created the clinic. She is now a judge, a magistrate judge, and fingers crossed, we're hoping that she's nominated for further things. Mm-hmm. But she really went out of her way to create this clinic and use it as an avenue to provide argument opportunities for the students. And so she was very rigorous about prep for the oral argument. We didn't work on the brief. The brief was drafted by the prior clinic team.
Sure.
And so prepping for an argument when you didn't write the brief is an entirely separate skill set.
Right.
And the professor was very committed to making sure that I was very prepared for the argument. I think I had 3 or 4 moots, including in front of her father, who was a former state Supreme Court justice.
Oh, wow.
And she made sure that my argument was recorded, so I got to watch myself back on video. She also provided advice on how to prep for arguments using note cards and a manila folder, and that's still my process for oral arguments. So it was very, very instrumental to how I conceive of myself as an appellate litigator, to be able to not just argue the case, but prep for it with someone holding my hand who was as fantastic as this professor.
Right. And that's the cool part, right, of doing these things when you're really junior or even in law school, if you can get the opportunity, is the stakes are lower because people know it's your first time, but you can really give your all and see if it's a great fit. And like best case scenario is you find what you want to do for the rest of your life. Like second best case scenario is you're like, I don't really want to do that again. And that's okay too. But you found something that you really were drawn to. And you started to mention this a little bit, but I want to drill a little bit deeper. When you went to private practice after you had an opportunity to clerk and finish law school, were you doing appellate work right away, or how did that all work out? And what were those years like?
Yeah, so I ended up at a firm, the first firm that I was at didn't have an appellate practice. I was at 2 different law firms, neither of which had appellate practices. One has since built an appellate practice. But in order to maintain an appellate resume and gain the experience I was hoping to gain, I took most of my appellate work on pro bono. Mm-hmm. And I was at firms that very much valued pro bono. And so within a year of starting back at the law firm, I actually reached out to the coordinators for the Ninth Circuit directly. There's a program where you can sign up to get emails about cases pro bono, but those are very competitive. So typically the email goes out to, I don't even know how many hundreds of people.
Right.
And it's difficult to secure a case that way. So I ended up emailing the coordinators directly and said, I'm fresh off a clerkship. I would really like to take on a case pro bono. And so they sent one directly.
Wow.
And I was able to take on a Ninth Circuit case with my law firm. At the time, I was a 2L. I staffed it. It was myself and a 1L. So that way, I wasn't at risk of someone taking the oral argument.
Smart.
And she was outstanding. And we worked together on the brief. And then the argument came up when I was a third year associate. I think I might have just said 3L. I meant second year associate.
Right. I got it. And I heard you. And that makes so much sense. And it's amazing how if you ask for something, like maybe it'll actually come to you. Like one of the things I remember coming off my appellate clerkship is I wanted to sort of get back into appellate work. And my firm had an appellate practice, but the timing just didn't work out with the cases I was on and the cases the firm had. And just something as simple as if you ask, maybe somebody will give it to you is a really good reminder, especially for junior lawyers, I think.
Definitely. And being collaborative with it.
Yes.
I think all of those things sometimes giving people an opportunity to say yes or no is a lot easier than having them think of you in the first instance. And so, especially with places here, even if there's an existing infrastructure, sometimes asking gives you unique opportunities.
I love that. If the worst case scenario is someone says no and it's not a big deal to them, then there's no real harm in asking. What other kinds of work were you doing when you weren't doing appellate work pro bono?
I did a whole array of litigation first. So I started in California. That's why I'd reached out to the Ninth Circuit and the firm's Los Angeles office. That's where I'm originally from. So I was staffed on a number of both state and federal traditional litigation matters, drafting summary judgment briefs, even discovery. When we moved to DC, I moved to that firm's DC office, was doing a lot of the same kind of traditional litigation, but the firm was moving more in a corporate direction and there was less and less true litigating opportunity beyond pro bono work. A lot of it was advising on corporate deals, but potential litigation in connection with corporate deals. So I looked to Lateral to a firm that would allow me to do more litigation, and Lateral to a different firm in DC that also at the time didn't have an appellate practice. And I jumped straight into a trial. There was a merger trial between two healthcare companies that the Department of Justice was challenging. And that was fantastic because we were in the midst of discovery. And then from there went to trial within a couple months of starting at the firm. So I really got to spend every day going to trial within a couple months of joining this other firm, and then was doing traditional litigation there, discovery, brief writing, and then supplementing with pro bono appellate work.
Yeah. If you're listening to this and think that you can just join a firm and it's natural that you get put on a case and go right to trial, let me disabuse you of that notion. That doesn't always happen. You know, the reason I was asking is because clearly your path started in appellate work and sort of now is in appellate work. And I was curious if that time working as a trial lawyer, as a big law litigator, doing discovery and motions practice and everything else, how has that affected your sort of appellate lawyer brain? And do you think you're a better appellate lawyer for having had even a little bit of that experience?
Definitely. I think that being able to be embedded in a trial team from the beginning is the best way to be an appellate lawyer. At least that's what I envision for myself, because you can help shape the record as it's happening, but with an eye towards the appeal. If you come in when the notice of appeal is filed, then you don't really have much control over what the record looks like, and you just have to work with what comes your way, which some of there are excellent lawyers out there who can do a great job with that. But I think being embedded as an appellate lawyer from the beginning is a really valuable way to run a case.
Yeah. And that obviously takes foresight, that takes client buy-in, that takes trial team buy-in. But it sounds like that is becoming increasingly important, especially in sort of the big cases and the big issues, just based on people I've interviewed on the podcast. The connection between trial and appeals, for a while, people used to just be their own appellate lawyers. Then we had appellate lawyers, and now the appellate lawyers are working with the trial lawyers during the trial. Is that sort of right? Is that where we are in today's appellate work?
I think so. I think it went from this idea in the marketplace that excellent lawyers were excellent lawyers and they could do anything, to a place where we had an appellate expertise and various firms were opening kind of appellate practices. And now we're at a place where folks view the appellate expertise as something that is valuable throughout the litigation. It's a different way of looking at the case. You're looking at what's bubbling up in other cases, what's the Supreme Court interested in? What are other issues that we can see the Supreme Court taking? Take, for example, qualified immunity. The court hasn't taken a qualified immunity case recently, but a lot of appellate litigators would be familiar with the likelihood that qualified immunity is something that the court may well take at some point. So if you're embedded in a trial team and that's a big issue in the case, you'd help the team litigate in a way that prepares for appellate review of that sort of issue. And so I think now we've come around as a marketplace to recognizing that that perspective is something that's valuable throughout litigation.
So talk to me about the change from going to private practice to going to the Solicitor General's office. I'm sure that was a big change type of practice. Talk to me about how you got that job and what that job was like compared to your jobs in private practice in your early years.
Sure. So I still have to pinch myself to remind myself that this is reality and that it actually happened, because I think that job really transformed my career. I don't have the traditional appellate resume. A lot of my colleagues have gone to different law schools than I went to or had clerked on the Supreme Court, whereas I haven't. And I think it's the opportunity to work in a state solicitor general's office that really opened the door to a true appellate career. It came about because I was kind of thinking about things I might want to do. Eventually, I really liked being at a law firm, but I wanted the opportunity to argue more cases, and I wanted to work directly with appellate practitioners who I could learn more directly from. And one of my friends from law school was Deputy Solicitor General of a different state, and he received mentorship and advice to that steered him towards state litigation and representing a state. And when I heard about his job, I just thought that was the coolest job I'd ever heard of. So when I saw the opportunity arise in Virginia and for a solicitor general who was extremely well respected in the appellate world, I figured I'd apply. I had no expectation that I would get an interview, let alone the position. I applied, I think it was in February, and initially spoke to the solicitor general, but we weren't sure if I'd be able to wave into the Virginia bar. And so I didn't hear anything for nearly 6 months.
Wow.
Until I did hear something from him, and I came in to interview the next day, and it all happened very quickly from there. But it was really emulating one of my friends who had a similar job that made me aware of state SG's offices, because at the time, big law, there was a lot of a focus on going to federal government opportunities. I don't think state AG offices were as prominent as they are today. And so I feel very fortunate that my friend got this advice so that I could kind of emulate some of it.
Yeah, I like how you sort of pulled it back a little bit, because I think sometimes when people hear about, like, I just got this job and they interviewed me yesterday and then I have the job today, it seems like it just happened in an instant, but it was also like, you were already arguing appeals in law school. You were listening to friends. You had applied even though you didn't weren't sure you were going to get your fit. It's the sort of myth of the overnight success. And that sounds sort of like what it was for your experience. Talk to me a little bit about what it's like to actually work in a state SG's office. Like, what makes it different? What makes it tick? What makes it interesting?
Yeah, so each state functions very differently. Some state SG's offices handle every appeal for the state. That's not the case in Virginia. Virginia's Solicitor General's office is quite small. It's a little bigger now, but at the time that I joined, it was just the Solicitor General and two deputies. Eventually, we took on a fellow, and eventually we took on an assistant, but it's a pretty small office compared to other states. The office was responsible for, we called it three buckets. The first bucket was everything in the United States Supreme Court, and we had three Supreme Court cases that were argued at the time that I was in the office.
Wow.
The second bucket is most matters before the Fourth Circuit and the Virginia Supreme Court. We kind of handled basically everything other than run-of-the-mill criminal appeals or habeas cases. And then the third bucket is what we called the Washington Post bucket. So anything that the Washington Post might report on, we would advise and handle. So there, for example, multi-state matters, most of them came through the Solicitor General's office, or high-profile litigation. So for example, we were the lead on litigating the Equal Rights Amendment, and when Virginia ratified, suing the federal government to vindicate ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. So we handled that from drafting the complaint on. That bucket ended up subsuming a lot of our work around the time, oh, I guess a little bit before you started this podcast. Pre-COVID, I'd say 80% of our work was appellate matters. Mm-hmm. Once COVID hit, we were one of the first lines of litigation and advising the governor on how to handle COVID. So at that point, I'd say our work flipped, and 80% of our work was trial level work, litigating against motions for temporary relief, preliminary injunctions, that sort of thing in the context of COVID. So I'd say the nature of the job changed tremendously once COVID hit, from an appellate shop to something that was more law heavy, but at any court, at any level of the case.
And talk to me a little bit about the politics of working in a state AG / Solicitor General's office. I mean, I grew up in Virginia. I know it has a rich tradition as a purple state. Not everybody in Virginia agrees about anything or everything. What was that like, sort of being such a high profile lawyer in a place where people don't always agree on what the best approach is?
I think that it definitely impacts the functioning of the AG's office and the way the office is kind of aware of the positions we take on issues. Ultimately, the attorney general makes those calls in Virginia. The attorney general is an elected official. Each state, it's different how the attorney general is selected. But in Virginia, it's an election and it's a separate election from the governor's election. So in theory, in Virginia, you can have a governor of one party right. and an attorney general of another party. That's happened before in Virginia. But the political decision-making really comes down to the attorney general and his senior staff, or in theory, her senior staff can right. help advise making those sorts of decisions. Do we bring certain litigation? Do we sign on to certain multi-state briefs? What position do we have on certain issues, and how does that impacted by what's going on in the Commonwealth? So we had a lot of matters involving access to firearms that was both in the context of COVID and before COVID. At one point, the governor closed Capitol Square to firearms and prevented, there was an executive order about restricting access to firearms in Capitol Square before a big rally. And so there was a last minute litigation about that that went up from the time the complaint was filed to the time we won in the Supreme Court of Virginia. I think it was something like 36 hours.
Wow.
So that's there's wild. All kinds of issues, yeah, that come up, and there are, each state has its own issues that are unique to that state. But like you said, Virginia is very much a purple state. And I think officials there, definitely my boss at the time, was very cognizant of what's important to the citizens of the Commonwealth and what do they care about, and definitely was aware of the ramifications of litigation in the context of a state like Virginia.
That's great. And before we sort of move into the more brass tacks, I want to ask you some questions about how to be a great appellate lawyer. But before we get there, I guess my last question about the SG's office is, to someone who's listening to this who might still be in law school or sort of early in their career, and they're thinking about, you know, I think a lot of the push, frankly, is for federal judiciary jobs, like federal clerkships. A lot of the push is for federal government jobs. What's both the reason why you'd consider applying to sort of a state court job or an SG's office? And how can you set yourself up to sort of be a good candidate if you're earlier in your career?
Sure. So I think one thing to think about is that depending on the state, you can have amazing opportunities in a way that is harder to have at a federal level. So just by way of my own personal experience, within 4 years of being in the Attorney General's office in Virginia, I got to argue, I think it was something like 23 cases.
Wow.
And I think that that sort of opportunity and that level of exposure is different than other jobs. It's definitely, I think, more argument experience than, for example, in the Department of Justice Solicitor General's office, which is focused more on the Supreme Court.
Sure.
You also get exposure to all kinds of different aspects of litigation and otherwise. So in Virginia, the Solicitor General's office was both kind of the main appellate shop, at least for the high profile appeals, but also helped out with other functions in the office. So helped with trial level issues, helped advise the attorney general, also helped with opinions sometimes. So the federal analog would be, you know, we were both the DOJ SG's office, civil appellate, sometimes criminal appellate, sometimes the Office of Legal Counsel, sometimes OLP. I mean, mm-hmm. So all these other areas that are separated at the federal level, we took on those sorts of roles in a state. So you really get a broad exposure to different legal issues in a way that's really unique at a state level. So I think that's just something unique for students to maybe consider when they're thinking about opportunities to go into a state.
I love that. And I think, right, this comes back to, frankly, what you did in law school, and you're talking about that part of your story. It's like, get those experiences, because experiences open doors. And it sounds like you got an incredible amount of experience in a short period of time. I love that idea of the Solicitor General's office being like having 8 or 10 federal equivalents at any given moment. But you can do that when there are fewer issues and the issues are of different size and scope. So I think that's awesome. I don't want to leave the SG's office or your appellate practice too much before we sort of do some nuts and bolts on appellate practice. As most listeners know, I'm a legal practice professor by trade. My students are all the Georgetown Law students are starting persuasive writing probably soon after this comes out. So I wanted to start by asking for either sort of an opinion or maybe even a hot take about how to be an effective advocate or appellate advocate.
Sure. I think one thing that makes an excellent appellate advocate is to know how to take very complicated issues and boil them down in a way that seems simple. The best advocates I know of, you'll pick up their brief and you'll read it, and it just seems like you just understand everything they say. And I think sometimes if you pick up a brief and it's hard to follow it, it's easy to think, well, the law here is very difficult. And that can very well be the case. But the best appellate litigators and the best judges, I think, can write in a way that anyone can pick up what it is that they wrote and understand that. And so I think that's true of excellent briefs as well. An excellent brief is self-contained. And so you give the background that you need on the facts or on the law all in that one document, so that when the clerk or the judge or whoever else picks up the brief, they can really follow what it is that your case is about. And I think a really good brief highlights that for the reader from the very get-go. What is this and why am I reading it? I think for oral advocacy, it's also very similar. The idea of boiling down a complex legal issue to just a couple of sentences is a very important skill. And I think the best oral advocates are able to do that. I think if students are looking to listen to the best of the business, I would say that there is no one better to listen to than our current Solicitor General, Elizabeth Prelogar. She is incredible and a phenomenal oral advocate and does such a great job of taking very complex issues and boiling them down to be digestible in a simple and easy to follow way.
And talk to me a little bit about the process of that, because that's a hard skill to teach. As someone who teaches written and oral advocacy, it's easy to say, make it straightforward, but we also sort of, legal language by definition sort of is syllogistic in nature and proof-based. How do you think about practically going from these are the big issues to I'm going to now be able to present them simply? What's that process look like for you?
First is outlining in a way that's easy to follow. So I think in drafting a brief, the organization is so important. And so I like to get the organization in my mind set before I draft a brief. I really don't want to be that person that's moving sections around in a brief after it's drafted. And so I find if I can have the organization straight in my head, it makes the brief easier to write. It makes it easier to prep for the argument. I think also kind of taking a number of steps back for younger lawyers or lawyers looking to break into the appellate field, working with really excellent writers and learning from them and growing from them, because there are all kinds of little techniques. For example, I find using dates and names can be distracting and hard to follow the narrative of a case unless those dates and names are important to what it is that you're arguing. And it's one of my many writing pet peeves to not include that. And I inherited that pet peeve from the then Solicitor General of Virginia, who I trained under, who I think is one of the absolute best writers that exists out there. He's now a Fourth Circuit judge, but he put together a whole protocol for our office of things to have that make good writing, including not having extraneous dates or names when drafting a brief. And so I really enjoy going through legal pet peeves because I've inherited so many from excellent writers I've worked with. And I think if someone aspires to really be an excellent writer, working with colleagues who are excellent writers and inheriting their neuroses is a great way to become excellent yourself.
Right. You say neuroses, I say craft. But yes, I think that's absolutely right. And that makes so much sense. We have a little more time. What's one more of your writing pet peeves? I'd love to sort of get one more in the episode.
Sure. I mean, this is very minor, but I'm big on M dashes and N dashes for blue book writing. I think that's just like an easy way to know whether or not somebody is careful with their writing. I think though, in terms of kind of substantive writing, I find that the summary of argument to me is the most important part of a brief. And I've disagreed with some colleagues about this as to whether it's the introduction or the summary of the argument that's the most important. But I find that if the summary of argument is clear and easy to follow, that's just a place that clerks and the judge can go to know what the brief is going to be about. I think the introduction is a great place to kind of put the case and the brief in the context of some bigger picture issue that's going on. It provides the lens through which the court can look at the issue. But I think that the summary of the argument, if I had to pick one area, is very important. And so one of my pet peeves is when people don't give a ton of thought to the different parts of the brief and how they all play together. And it's fine if somebody prefers to put more on the introduction than the summary of the argument, but it's when there's a lack of thought as to why those are there and what the purpose of the different part of a brief is. It's that lack of thought that can then lend itself to writing that's not as strong as when someone has really strong opinions as to the purpose of each part of a brief.
And if you're listening to this and you're a law student and you are getting excited by this conversation and you want to do this work, that might be a good sign that appellate work is for you. I won't make the opposite true, but that's the kind of conversation that the best of the best in this field, having interviewed a bunch of them, and I'm lucky to be in that position, often focus on those little things. And it's amazing how your big picture recommendation about making sure you can sort of simplify it to one issue also connects to your thoughts about how you use different sections of the brief. That's great. I think that's a good reminder for all the law students listening and starting their briefs as one else.
Yeah, and it's also a good reminder, I think part of it, that people disagree about these things, right? And so
100%.
I think great professors might preface their opinions, and some professors don't preface their opinions and say, this is the only way to do it. I think being attuned to different ways that excellent lawyers do their job and recognizing that there isn't just one way to do it is something that's really valuable. And it took me a long time in my career to reach that conclusion and realize that.
Absolutely. That's something I aspire to do in my own practice, but it's hard. When you have a preference and you think that's the right way to do it, you have to remember, unless you can explain why it's the right way to do it, you're not necessarily doing anybody a service. So it's a good reminder. You mentioned earlier on that you still prepare in the same way you learned how to prepare when you were a law student with note cards and a manila folder. Tell me a little bit about that preparation process.
Yeah, so I wish we could have diagrams as part of a podcast, because I think you kind of have to see how the manila folder works. But basically, some of my colleagues will also use a manila folder, but they'll kind of print on two pieces of paper and then staple them or tape them to the manila folder. And I've seen a lot of appellate advocates use that. The note card trick, you kind of put the note cards one on top of the other. So what you carry onto the podium looks like just one manila folder, but you can get the content of all the note cards kind of piled on top of each other. And then you flip a note card and can see everything on there. And so what I would do for arguments is I'd have a note card about the key dates in the case, or I'll have one note card per key case, and then the relevant quotes or citations to the key parts of the case. And so as I'm prepping for oral argument, I will create my manila folder with all the information that I want, all the record citations, just all the things that I know I can't memorize, but it looks very small, even though there's a lot of information on there. And then I also write out my opening. Then ideally I memorize, but I also like having it there in front of me in case I lose my train of thought.
Sure.
And that's inside the manila folder. And so when I prep, I write out what it is I'm going to say. Back when I started oral arguments, judges would often just jump in immediately to the argument. I think now with the culture where the Supreme Court has a respected time period that an advocate can kind of get out what they want to argue, it seems like a lot of lower courts have been emulating some of that as well. So I'll typically prepare for 2 to 3 minutes of uninterrupted time, then with the expectation that I get interrupted. And for the parts where courts are asking questions, because really the goal is for oral argument is for courts to ask questions, I'll prepare my answers ahead of time. I don't memorize them, but I'd like to try to predict both through talking with colleagues and through moots what questions will be asked and then be pretty prepared to answer them in an organized way. So if I know I'm going to get a question about X, I know that in response, there are three things I want to say. Mm-hmm. And so even in my answer, I'll say, I have 3 points to that, Your Honor, first, blah, blah, blah. And the benefit of that is it allows you to then organize in your head and then also refer back to it over the course of argument in case you get interrupted after first. You can say, well, and Your Honor, that brings me back to the second point, and then come back to the argument. So that also allows you as the advocate to kind of have a little bit of control over the argument and where it heads so that you're not just on the receiving end of questions. You're also helping move the argument forward along in a productive way.
Now you've moved into sort of act number, whatever act we're on. And I love multi-act legal careers. Talk to me a little bit about the transition. And I'm also curious, what the differences are now that you're sort of someone who works on appellate work at a private law firm, having done all of those arguments and done all of that interesting work in the state SG's office. Talk to me about what you do now and also sort of how it differs or is the same as the prior work you've done.
Sure. So I think I'm still figuring that out. I've been at the firm now for a year, and I feel so fortunate to be at a firm with such a fantastic appellate practice. Jenner's appellate bench is unparalleled. There are just some phenomenal lawyers who I can call colleagues now, and also people who came through Jenner's appellate practice. And so having the opportunity to work with them and learn from them has been fantastic. I'm navigating kind of what level of work I'll do in terms of balancing both federal and state work. I've done both federal and state work, but I love litigating before the Supreme Court of Virginia. So if I can continue building a practice doing that, I would absolutely love to do that. I've brought in my first case to the Supreme Court of Virginia, and so I'm hoping to kind of continue on with that. That court has some of the loveliest judges out there, justices out there, and it's shout out for the law students who are looking for clerkships. I don't think you can get much better than the Supreme Court of Virginia and clerking with some of the fantastic justices there or the judges on the Court of Appeals of Virginia.
Wait, before you keep going, I want to know, what about the Supreme Court of Virginia besides the judges themselves as people makes it such a rich place to be a lawyer and argue at?
I think there's a level of collegiality and kindness that is really unique to that court, to me, special in Virginia. A lot of the justices came through, for example, the Attorney General's office. So when you're arguing there on behalf of the Attorney General's office, they know who you are and they think fondly. I think they're also very cognizant of the broader picture in which they're practicing. And so talking about how certain arguments can connect up with what's going on in Virginia, like deference to the General Assembly. Virginia is fascinating because it has this really rich common law history. And so the justices are very versed in that. And so I think there's a culture that's unique to that court, both in terms of the substantive legal issues, the people on the bench and their histories, and then also just a level of courtesy and kindness that I think is really meaningful. The idea that litigants are to treat each other with a level of respect. It's just something that's really special in that court.
That's great. I love that. I guess I'm curious about also sort of the other kinds of work you're doing besides in state court.
Sure. So I do a kind of mixture of integrating into the firm's existing practices and betting in trial courts, and then also maintaining the commitment to pro bono. I've done a couple of pro bono cases, both pro bono amicus briefs and pro bono merits matters. And then what I really enjoy is helping provide opportunities for associates. And so I'm working with a colleague, one of our associates is scheduled to argue before the Fourth Circuit next month. So overseeing his work on a Fourth Circuit case. And then we have two petitions for appeal, the equivalent of a cert petition in the Supreme Court of Virginia that two associates are handling there, and then one in the Court of Appeals of Virginia. And so being able to maintain the commitment to pro bono, but also help open doors for associates to have argument opportunities and opportunities to lead briefing, that's really been meaningful and something I've enjoyed being able to do upon returning to private practice.
And I won't embarrass Michelle too much, but to say that one of her associates actually recommended that I interview her on the podcast. So I had been a fan from afar because we have various personal and professional connections, but it wasn't until her associate said, you have to interview Michelle, that I was like, well, then I have to interview Michelle if you think so. If you're an associate listening and you'd like me to interview somebody, I take those recommendations really highly. And it speaks highly of you that your associates want to put you out there because you're helping put them out there and teaching them, giving them opportunities as well. So I think that's awesome.
I really value being able to work with excellent associates. I think that sometimes the narrative that we have in the legal profession can be hierarchical. And I think that if we can transcend that and see that we have fantastic colleagues, not just senior to us, but also sometimes junior to us, it's really meaningful to be able to work with more junior associates, to work with summer associates, to work with law students. And so I feel very lucky to have fantastic colleagues at every level of practice.
And what's one thing that sort of someone who is a more junior person who's working for you, either as a summer associate or a new associate, what's one thing that can make those people stand out to you and say, yes, I want to give that person an opportunity, or I want to help them move to the next step, besides the fact that they're just happen to be in your office? What's something that helps those folks stand out?
I think somebody who views themselves as a full member of a team in a way that they take ownership over what it is that they do. And I know we say a lot of times, like, take ownership over your work, but it's hard to understand what that means. To me, what that means is not just waiting for someone to say, do this and do this at this time. And if you're not given a deadline, then assuming you have forever to do it, but taking that initiative to try and see the world through the perspective of the people you're working with and ask about, you know, if you have a discrete research project, how does this fit into the broader picture of what's going on? How can I track other things going on in the case? Are there other cases that involve a similar issue? I would love to track them. And then if something happens in those cases, bringing it to my attention and saying, did you see this happened in this other case? I wonder if it can impact our analysis on this piece of the brief. And so I think associates who view themselves as a full-fledged team member and are just as committed to the work, such that if I, God forbid, get sick and I'm not able to work on the brief, or let's say I'm on vacation and want to actually enjoy my vacation without constantly jumping back into things, I know that they're fully committed. So they have the ability to kind of take over, or at the very least, really, really identify places that are important to elevate. And then also, one thing that's like a very helpful concrete that I received is being able to not just present a problem, but present a solution too. So to say, we argue that case X says Y, actually case X says Z, or case X was overturned, definitely bring that to my attention. But if you can say in addition to that, okay, so case X was overturned, but it's been appealed further, I'm tracking the appeal. And also, here are some other cases that we can cite instead. And here's a footnote that we can add to the brief to note that it's been overturned, but also why that doesn't matter. Then you're providing a menu of options that make it really easy to handle the problem beyond just pointing to a problem, which then suggests that the solution falls only on my shoulders.
I love that. And I think it's so easy when you're given an assignment and the advice is like, do this assignment well, just like kind of like put on blinders. But it sounds like, and I've heard this before from other guests, that the best associates are able to put on those blinders and answer the question, but also have that wider view.
Definitely. And be committed to each other as human beings, right? I think the idea that just because you work with someone, and I completely respect some people when they work with people, they want to separate their work life and their personal life. I really love what I do. So I also want to be friends with the people I work with. And so an associate who wants to develop that relationship, you know, is interested in talking about their career aspirations and I'd love to help them. Or if they're interested in mine, being able to have that back and forth beyond just the one case we're working on, but really being kind of colleagues in a way, maybe even being friends. I mean, my colleagues from the Virginia Solicitor General's office are some of my best friends. I know that the etiquette today is to text people before you call them, but some of them have received calls from me just to catch up while I'm driving to and from work. Right.
They've crossed that line of friendliness.
Yeah. And I think I've given in that I'm just that person that's just going to be weird and just call people. But I find that being friends with the people you work with can really make the job much more enjoyable. And some of my best friends are people who used to be colleagues.
Yeah. And it lasts beyond that particular work relationship. I have several friends who I'm still very close with from my time at the law firm as well. And those are life-changing friends on a personal level and on a professional level. I think it's a really good message that people forget. So we're getting close to the end of our conversation, which I can't believe has flown by. I always like to end these discussions by asking for a piece of advice for something you wish you knew when you were just starting out or just graduating law school, or something that you would tell somebody who's in that position. What's something you would leave for those folks?
I think one thing, if I had to have one motto that I would like to guide my career by, is to just surround yourself with excellent people. Sometimes it's tempting to take an opportunity because it's shiny and prestigious, and it could be great, but it's really important to make sure that you are surrounded with really, really excellent people, people who are ethical, people who are nice, and people who are really good at what they do. And if you do that, I think you're equipped to be able to handle the various challenges that can come up. People will be nice if you're facing some personal issues. Both my kids came 6 weeks early. So being able to have colleagues who are understanding and kind about that was really meaningful. And I think if you are surrounded by people who are also substantively really excellent at what they do, you'll develop really good habits and be that much better of a lawyer. But if you can live by making sure to prioritize and surrounding yourself with excellent people, then you're well equipped to do very well in your career.
Fantastic. Well, I'm so glad we were able to do this, Michelle. I'm grateful to the several people who recommended you, but especially your associate who said you have to interview Michelle. Michelle, if people are interested in hearing more and learning more from you and about you, where can they find you?
Sure. So they can find me on my firm's website, and my email is there, my phone number is there. They can also find me on my public Instagram. The handle is Appeals in Heels. And my hope there is to give folks a little bit of a glimpse into the life of what it's like to be a lawyer in the appellate world, and also balancing the commitments of having two little kids at home, a busy spouse, and all the insanity that is having an appellate career. So folks can find me either of those places.
Absolutely. Well, this was great to get this opportunity to chat, Michelle, and I hope we can do it again sometime soon. And thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or at Jonah Perlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week.